Love you, man.
Thank you so much.
My name is Don Shipp, and I'm an alcoholic, a real alcoholic. I'd like to thank Milton for asking my wife, Dewey, and I to come up and visit with you a little while this weekend. And the committee, I don't want to put that burden completely on Milton for having me tonight. The committee, I'm sure, passed on it, Milton. I don't want you to bear the burden of me being here completely. It has been a wonderful weekend. We drove up Thursday through Mississippi, Alabama, and on into into Tennessee, and enjoyed it very much. The trip and the fellowship has been wonderful. He said, my sobriety date is December the 25th, 1964. I don't want any of you to strain your brain with figuring you hadn't got that many toes and fingers. So that's 34 years, 4 months, and 1 week. I was born out in Calhoun County in the hills of Mississippi in March the 22nd, 1927. And again, I don't want you to start figuring. I'm 72 years old plus. I married this fine lady that is still managing to stay with me in 1947. And again, I don't want you to anybody to strain your brains. That's 52 years. And I think she's entitled to some recognition. Honey, would you please stand up? She's a well-preserved, beautiful lady because of my constant and undivided attention that I've given her these 52 years. I am reminded to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'll put this watch on the table here. I don't tell time, but it looks good, and it will give you a sense that maybe you won't stay here all night. I really enjoy roundups. I hope you've got a sense of humor, because I believe very sincerely that God meant for me to be happy. And I've learned that during my sobriety that I don't want to disappoint God. Because the wrath of God can be pretty severe if you cross him. So I think he meant to be happy, and I'm going to try my best to please him. And if it doesn't please you, that's your problem. But if you'll drift along with me, the chances are you'll have fun too. Because that's what this program has done for me. I came to the program a mess is not the good description. I wasn't a derelict. Well, maybe I was. I don't know what a derelict is. You know, I'm not too smart. But I really enjoy these roundups and conventions. I've been to 34 state conventions consecutively in Mississippi and missed one. I made a lot of difference in between. What I think they do to me, you know, when you're my age and been sober as long as I am and been married to the same woman that long, You get kind of, you know, up to a plateau and you don't get any further. You know, you kind of level off, I'd say. And it's hard to keep your energy leveled at the, as somebody mentioned, you know, your excitement and all that. And I think these conventions and jubilees and roundup, you know, these rockets that they have, they get off the ground to a certain point. And then you got to have a booster. I mean, it won't go no further. It just gets up and stalled. I guess it fall back on the ground. I don't know. So they light that darn booster thing, and it kicks them on into outer space. And these airplanes and things have got these jet engines, you know, and they get up to a certain point, and then they have to kick these, what do you call them, afterburners that gives them another thrust, you know, Otherwise, they'd just get to that and you wouldn't go any faster, do any better. And really what I'm speaking about is I kind of get supercharged, I guess you'd call it. And you may not understand what supercharged is, but somebody told me what it was one time, that this fella had a outfit at the edge of the desert where he rented camels. And the camels would rent for so much, say $100, and he would let you and you go across the desert, ride these darn camels. And the fellow said, "Well, I've got to go a little further than that." Said, "I've got to go further than $100 a camel." He said, "Oh, that's no problem." Said, "I can give you one that for $150 that will go a lot further." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He'll be supercharged." Said, "How you do that?" He said, "Well, you watch me." Said, "I'll lead this camel over to the water hole." And said, "He drinks, puts his nose down in the water, and he drinks and drinks. You know, a camel can hold a lot of water. And he drinks and drinks and drinks." And said, "I get behind him with this sharp stick." And said, "Just before he takes his mouth out of the water," said, "I job him with that in the rear end with that sharp stick." And he said, "Oh, that's a supercharged camel when he sucks it." So that's what this roundups do for me. I get that. That extra charge. As I mentioned, I was born out in the hills of Calhoun County in the late 20s. And try to give you a little background on why I'm like I am, maybe. I had real, real good parents. I had a wonderful parents. I didn't drink amount to anything till I got out of the Navy and finished college. So I really don't have any drinking history, but I'll give you a little background. My parents were fine people. My daddy didn't cuss, and I don't much, and because he didn't teach me how, you know. But I remember him cussing twice. My mother used to, some of you women, the old women, they used to make patchwork quilts, you know, and they had these quilting frames that they let down out of the ceiling and put their quilt on there, and they sat around that quilt and quilted. That's kind of their social life. And four or five of my mother's neighbor women would come in, and they'd sit around and talk and quilt them, make them patchwork quilts. And I was a little old boy, and I remember Daddy been out working all day, and Mama and these women had been fixing them quilts. And when they got through, you had to pull them up in the ceiling. Well, my mother's kind of short. She wasn't very tall, and she couldn't get it quite high enough. And Daddy had been out working all day long. He worked hard and expected everybody around him to. So he came in, and when he did, he hit his head on them quilting cranes and skinned his head, and he rubbed it, and he said, "Damn, Matty, couldn't you get them no higher?" That's the only time. Well, I heard him cuss an old cow one time. He said, that damn old cow going to run me crazy if she don't stay in the pasture. But that's just kind of home I lived in. It was a good home. I went to grammar school, high school, and a little community school, and didn't have any problems. I was accepted. I was a fair athlete, and from an old family, we lived there, and everybody got along. It was during the Depression, and nobody had too much, so it didn't bother anybody because everybody had the same thing, mostly nothing, and had plenty to eat. Good environment in my home, and a roof over our head, and some clothes. That's all I really thought about. But long about the latter part of World War II, they were having a war, and I got patriotic, and at the end of my junior year in the 11th grade of high school, I joined the Navy, and I still didn't have any problems, no drinking amount to anything in the military, and made it through after a tour of duty in the Pacific and as a pharmacist mate, and came back home, and well, I got home and I went to college after I finished high school. Went to college in married this, I came back right after I got back and asked this young lady to marry me. And I think it was a wonderful decision, because somebody told me during my trying to get sober, said, you know, I didn't realize how smart God was. And I said, well, I don't know, but why? He said, there's millions of women in the world, and said he picked out the only one that could have put up with you. So that's God's brilliance. So he got this young lady. But I am kind of an unusual alcoholic, I guess you'd call it. I've only been married that one time, and I never lost a business. I never been in jail. Well, I'll explain that. When I started my drinking after I got out of college, I had a brother who was a highway patrolman in the town that I had a drugstore. And every time I'd get stopped by the people, knew my brother. He'd been an older highway patrolman, and all the law enforcement knew each other. And one of them would look at my license, and he'd say, Don Shipp. So, you any kin to Jack? I say, yeah, I'm his younger brother. He said, man, I hate to lock Jack's brother up. And I said, I hate if you lock him up, too. And that's the way I got by. Well, in the town I was living in, things got a little shaky, and I thought it would be better. I had a chance to get rid of a business I had at a reasonable price and move to another town. And lo and behold, the man I was in business with in Clarksdale, where I live now, was the mayor. And at that time, the mayor was in charge of the police department, and the chief and all of them had come in to talk to the mayor. And here I'm his pharmacist. Yeah, we're in business together. Well, every time the police in Clarksdale would see me out at places that I shouldn't be and behaving like I shouldn't, they'd say, darn, Don, said, you shouldn't be out here. Said, you know, this is no place for you to be. Said, you need to go home. And I never did argue with police too much. And a few times I did, and I found out that wasn't reasonable. And I'd do what they told me usually, and they'd either send me home or take me home. So not being in jail really wasn't my fault. It was theirs. I was entitled to some jail time. But I continued to drink, and of course you might understand and realize that my marriage and relationship with my wife was getting a little shaky. She has always had a bad sense of humor. It's gotten a little better since I quit drinking. She can see the bright side of some things now, but anyway, she got, somebody said that was the maddest woman they ever saw when I came to this program. And she was in a bad humor, and somebody asked her one time, did she ever think about divorcing me? And she said, no, I really, of course, she's one of them hard shell Baptists, till I converted her to the Methodism, and she didn't believe in divorce, I don't think. Well, she believed in it, but she never did. Anyway, she didn't. She said, murder was what crossed my mind most recently. I'll explain that, too, in a minute. But anyway, I kept drinking. Of course, my family relationship, I got four wonderful children now, and still got that same wife. My relationship with those children, of course, had deteriorated. I had a business partner, and he'd kind of got disgruntled with me, and he'd call me in every once in a while and talk to me, you know, when some news would get back to him of some of my activities, and things were touchy. I'll kind of explain that. I love dogs. I've always had dogs, been very close. You know, I can associate with dogs and understand them, and they understand me, and I can relate to them, and they can relate to me. Yeah, I've kind of got a dog mentality, I reckon. And I had an old dog named Sniffles, and he kind of had my disposition. That I mentioned to somebody, I had dogs when I was drinking that had a bad disposition. The darn dog would bite you. They just didn't get along with nobody much. Now I've got wonderful dogs. They never bite anybody. They wag their tail, you know, and friendly. But anyway, we alcoholics learn survival techniques and how to get by with things. And I was bad about not having a real regular schedule. I come and go, and it wasn't at the same time all the time. And I didn't come home at the same time rarely. And most of the time it was late, and that would make her mad. She'd have some words. And anyway, I was out one night, and I had an old station wagon that slid into the curb and bent the back wheel, and they could see who I was, because that wheel, you know, when you're going down the highway, kind of give it that. And anyway, Sniffles would ride around with me, and I'd talk to him, and he'd talk to me, you know. That's about got to where people wouldn't associate with me much. Even a drunk, I couldn't even buy him a beer. He said, "No, thank you, I don't believe I," because I got antisocial. And anyway, I was riding around with Sniffles that night, and I wore him out. He finally lay down on the seat and went to sleep, and I came on home sometime, you know, late. And I got home, and of course, she was mad as usual, and got up the next morning, and she was still mad. Well, I had learned she had a dear mother. She was a fine lady. I really love Miss Ophelia. But anyway, I had learned that she was a widow and lived by herself in pretty good peace. And I had learned that if she got on me too heavy, I'd say, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. You hadn't been to see your dear widowed mother in so many months." And anyway, I caught on to that morning. I said, "We need to go see Miss Ophelia. You hadn't seen her. You ought to be ashamed." Bye bye. Well, okay. So she starts getting the children ready, and she goes out to put something in the old station wagon. Well, she was mad when she went out there, but she was a raving maniac when she come back, mad as a wet hen. And I couldn't figure out what she's so mad about. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Just go look in that station wagon." Well, I was a little bit afraid to, because, you know, occasionally you'd give a person a ride home, and it didn't really matter if it's male or female if they need to ride home. And and all I could think of, as mad as she was, I said, "I must have meant to take somebody home, and I left them in the car." And I was really kind of uptight about going and looking in that automobile. And anyway, she raised so much hell, I might as well face the music and go in there and see who it was. Well, I get out there, and what had happened is Sniffles was asleep on the seat, and he was housebroken. He got to want to use the bathroom and wanted out of the car. Well, he tore all that overhead stuff, you know, scratching, and it was hanging down, that cloth stuff out of the ceiling, and the doors he'd scratched and tore that. It was a mess. He still had to use the bathroom. And I was so happy, you know, I was just tickled to death that that's all it was. And, you know. It was kind of humorous now, but it was touchy right at that particular time. Kind of give you a sense of my business ability. I'll explain to you. I had a drugstore, and we were doing all right. Wasn't any real problem. But anyway, I was always going on these buying trips and business trips and whatever. You know, you always had business to do. Anyway, I went to Memphis and on a business trip, of course, and down on the waterfront there in Memphis, up and down that rough section. If you've been in Memphis, you know what? There's a joint down there, place, and about midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock, there's some real interesting people you run up on at those places. And I run up on this fella, and he asked me what I did, and I, of course, you embellish things a little bit when you're drinking. You don't really, I didn't lie much. I told him I had a chain of drugstores and had one with a partner, but that's all right. And anyway, I asked him what he did. He said, well, I'm in the hammer handle business, and we talked there a while, and he convinced me that anybody with a chain of drugstores should have a good supply of hammer handles. And I go out, and he's got a big big bob truck loaded. Now, he did have, he was hauling somebody's hammer handles, and I backed up there with my car, and we began to unload hammer handles. He filled it up, and all the back seat and part of the front, you know, where I wasn't sitting. And we were talking and discussing this. Anyway, I bought a lot of all the hammer handles I could get in that car and came on home, you know, a good business deal. I don't need dwelling on it. And didn't have but one old vehicle at that time, you know. A fellow drunk, he can't handle but one car. And the next morning, lo and behold, she had to buy, had to use a car. Had to take the children to do something. Otherwise, I could have dumped them hammer handles over the 4th Street Bridge and I'd been over. But there she sees that and she said, my Lord, you know, what did you buy them hammer handles for? And I never have been able to explain it to her. Some people just don't have a good business head on them, you know, like I did. And anyway, I've still got some of them there. That's been... I had a bunch of brother-in-laws that farmed. I tried to give them some till they got to talking funny about me. You know, I've often thought about the depth of degradation that I reached during my drinking. I still got some character defects. I'd like to hang on to some of them. My wife loves them. She's watered them and put Miracle-Gro on them and kept them alive and happy so she can remind me. You know, that keeps us... keep the lines of communication open most of the time when she finds a character defect that she can remind me of. So she likes Miracle-Gro. She's one of their favorite people. But life become rather precarious around my home at that particular time. And one of the times that I learned another trick, that if she got on me too bad, I'd go through this rigmarole of, I can't stand it anymore. This is driving me crazy, and you're not helping any. And I'm going to blow my brains out. And I had a bunch of old shotguns, and I had one particular, an old pump gun that made a lot of racket. You know, you could pump it and, you know, get her attention. And then she'd come running in, oh, honey, well, put it up now. We'll talk about it in the morning. And I'd get her off my back, and... Well, this one particular time I came in and she started that, discussion that I didn't have a right to answer. And I said, I just can't stand anymore. You're driving me crazy. And I went and got the old gun and started that racket and pumping routine to get her attention that I just gonna blow my brains out. She said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to blow my brains out, but I can't find the shells. Well, she had put them up, you know. She had hid the shells, afraid maybe something I might accidentally shoot one of the children, but she went around the corner in the closet there, come back with a whole box of shells and said, here they are. You kind of get the gist of how our relationship was going at that particular time. And at the end of that last year of my drinking career, I got to worrying. You know, I'm thinking that this good woman is having a hard time, and I believe I'll take some insurance. I'll give her something to hang on to until she finds a mate that a little more decent than I am. I think I was being honest about this thing, and that I was getting where she didn't really like me around the house. It gotten kind of cold, and I went to a doctor. I thought, well, I'll take some insurance and give her something to live on. And so, lo and behold, that company wouldn't write me any insurance. Said my health had deteriorated. And another old doctor a year or two previous had told me I better change my lifestyle. I wasn't going to live long. Why, he's old. He didn't always talk about much. You know, he wasn't up on modern medicine. I didn't pay much attention. But this was a younger fella. Well, I didn't believe him much. So anyway, I went to three different doctors to get insurance. You know, they had to have a physical. And I found out that I couldn't get any insurance. So I got to thinking, well, maybe, you know, these people, these insurance companies, if they'll take your premiums and write you insurance if they think you're going to live. I mean, that's just common sense. And maybe there's something wrong with me. So I'm a disabled veteran from World War II, and I thought, well, they've got to take me, so I take off to Jackson. I had an old suitcase. She put me on a Greyhound, but wouldn't let me drive the car. And I get to Jackson to checked in the VA hospital, and that blame admitting physician wasn't very nice, and I think he's a little irritated with me. He wanted me to, I carried a gun all this time. I felt a little more comfortable, kind of like this AA book now. That's my security blanket, but that old 38 was my security blanket when I was drinking, and, you know, felt better. And he wanted me to leave it. He didn't want me to take it on the ward with me. He and I kind of got in an argument about it. And anyway, the ward boy convinced me to leave it. He'd put it in an old box or something, and the doctor told the ward boy, said, take him up to Ward 4C down to VA Hospital in Jackson. And thinking thing, I did think something. He took off all my clothes, gave me some old drawstring pajamas and some pasteboard shoes, and sent me up to Ward 4C. And we go up, and he unlocks the door down, and we go in. He locks it behind me. We go down the hall, he unlocks another door, and he locks it behind me. And I'm thinking, this is unusual for high blood pressure wards. Anyway, wasn't but a few days till I figured out this wasn't a high blood pressure ward. There's some people on there, there was about 10 or 15 of us had a drinking problem. At this time, they didn't have treatment centers in 63, and, you know, kind of got dumped with the rest of the crazy people, and it was weird. That was a real experience to be on a nut ward. I really enjoyed it because it was the beginning of the end of my drinking, because I had gotten to the point that it was getting bad. And during this time, I realized I had that drinking was my problem. And anyway, I told somebody today, I feel real proud of myself during that stay. I'd been there maybe a month and got dried out and knew where I was and everything. And the nurse one day, some of those people were pitiful. I'm serious. It was bad. They were mental cases. And if they left the ward, the hospital, they couldn't find any way back. She wanted to know if I would take a group of them and you know, exercise them, let them walk around the grounds and get them back. And I was so proud of myself, I was a guide in the nut ward. I had another good experience there. I got to wondering what was wrong with me, and, you know, I mean, what they thought was wrong with me. That's quite different. And got to wondering how I was going to find out, because they wouldn't let me have my health record, you know. the chaplain, old Brother Vaughn, came up one day to hold services, and asked him something about what denomination he was, and he said he's Methodist, and I said, aha, I'm Methodist. And he and I got in a conversation, and anyway, I convinced him that I could help him in his office with his work there, so ministering to the people there in the hospital. And he let me come down because he couldn't type. And he said, Brother Vaughn needed somebody to type up health records. And I could type fairly well. And so I agreed to go down and type his health records for him. And I got the, of course, mine was the first one I got out of the file, you know. And I found out I had an anxiety complex. And it didn't mention nothing about drinking. And I thought, well, that's not too bad, you know. I'm locked up down here in this nut ward, and that'll give you a complex when you, you know. And I was anxious about when they were going to let me out, so I could, you know, anxiety complex made sense. I was in there and was upset, but what I really got to worry about, I'm still kind of concerned about it. I impressed him with my spiritual stamina and stuff, and I told him one day, I said, you know, he couldn't make it around all the wards. And I told him about my leadership in the Methodist Church in Clarksdale. And he let me go down whole services on the ward, you know, different wards. And I thought, this is neat, you know. I'm guiding the people on the nut ward, and I'm holding services. And I'm making a lot of progress. And I hope I'm sure I didn't send anybody to paradise with my administering. I just hope I didn't send anybody else the other way, you know, by that maneuvering. But this was the beginning of the end. I came back from at Nut Ward and started trying, because I knew at that time, as I told somebody, they put me on Thorazine. And I don't know whether y'all ever took Thorazine. That's the darndest. I'm a pharmacist, and I know drugs, and I never did take many. I sold a lot of them, but they told me I had to take Thorazine, and that's the weirdest thing, and it wasn't. Thorazine fixed me so that my physical movement and my brain weren't in the same gear. And one was going normal, and the other one going real slow. And I'd start somewhere, and it'd take me forever to get there. You know, you pick up your feet, and you let them down. And my business partner got to watching me around the corner peeping, and I got kind of embarrassed. I said, I believe I'd rather be drunk than taking this stuff. So I couldn't stand that. I afraid I'd strip a gear. And so I quit taking Thorazine. I said, so anyway, I tried my best during that year and a half, and that's when the real hell and misery set in. And you've heard of the four horsemen that I learned about real quick, and that I tried to deal with. And I also found out there's four more horsemen that had a hold of me. Guilt, remorse, shame, and fear. These are the list, not near enough for the shape I was in. And it was a terrible existence during that year and a half that I tried so desperately to quit drinking. So, excuse me, in December of 1964, I had, I guess I'd hit my bottom. I was in my drugstore there one day, and I had a convulsion. And I'd had them before, but not in public, in your own business, you know. Here you're there flopping around in the floor. My customers and my business partner didn't understand. And anyway, there was a physician right across the street, and he called him over, and he came running over with his, and I remember when I came to, I was laying on the floor, and they'd put something under my head to keep me beating the brains out and what I had left. And this little doctor was standing up over me. He's short, but he looked tall from where I was, and he read the riot act to me. He was my family physician, and his bedside manner had disappeared. And he was lecturing to me from up there and shaking his finger at me, and told me that I figured, well, he'd tell me I'd had a stroke or heart attack or something that I could deal with, and that wasn't what it was. He said that was withdrawal symptoms from alcoholism, and he went into all this mess that I already knew about. But anyway, he told me, said, if you don't quit drinking, well, he had another thing, said, but I'll work with you. I'll try. He said, This was kind of an enlightening thing. He said, I believe you're worth saving, maybe. And of course, he was kind of disgusted. Another thing he said, if you don't do something about this, your wife and I are going to have you committed. Well, she would have been real cooperative in helping him commit me, no doubt in my mind. She'd been delighted to sent me somewhere, which meant, of course, Whitfield, and I didn't want to go. So I agreed at that particular time to do something about it, and lo and behold, I had moved over in a new house. My dilemma was, about the time I got back from this nut ward, we'd moved over in this new house that I'm living in now. And how I bought a better house, I don't know, but I did. But anyway, drunks can con people into doing anything. But I moved about a block from the man who is my sponsor now. He'd been sober 52 years plus, and his wife was a good Al-Anon. And when I came home from the nut ward and moved over there, lo and behold, his wife started coming to my house a year and a half. Well, you can imagine the dilemma of a fella just gets out of a nut ward and at the same time his wife joins Al-Anon. Things got shaky around my house. First thing I thought, well, I didn't have to get no insurance. She done found another man because she wasn't behaving. She seemed happy and going about her, you know, didn't give a damn whether I was sober or not. And that bothered me. And she'd learned, I guess, about that detachment with love or something. I don't know, but I didn't know about it. She didn't explain it. She just went about her business, and I thought, well, anyway, during that year and a half, she was putting this Al-Anon mess on me, and as I told Louise, bless her heart, she knew me back when I first came in when I was shaking so bad. She came down to Clarksdale and talked, but I told them that about that time I thought instead of Al-Anon, it was Al-Aroids. Y'all don't understand, you know, that's them Al-Anons, it's a pain in the rear end. That's what I said. But she got better. When I quit drinking, see, she got a little better, and things kind of leveled off. And I'd like to tell you a minute about my children. I got four wonderful children. But the oldest boy was 13, and the oldest girl was 12, and the younger one about 10, 11, and a little boy, and younger than them. I think about it when I would come in drinking, this little fella, the little baby boy, he was just was kind of small, 5-6 years old, I reckon. And the bigger children were trying, protective, you know how older children will try to take, you mentioned, I think, taking care of your little brothers and sisters. And bless his heart, they would, when I would come in drunk, and you know, I really didn't hurt them, you know, physically, but the mental anguish and the things that they had to go through with was traumatic. But they would put him in a closet. Every time I'd come in drunk, little old David, they'd put him in the closet. And he didn't understand, you know, why Daddy comes in and brother and sister put me in the closet. He told his mama the other day, he said, no wonder I'm, you know, mentally upset. But anyway, he and I have a wonderful relationship. I came to this program, and that wife got in a better humor. She leveled off, and she don't rarely have a booster rocket, but she's doing all right. But these children, I think that's what hurt me so bad and drove me to this program, is I couldn't stand seeing how those children looked at me. I know I hurt them awful bad and caused them a lot of mental anguish. And the when I quit drinking, I had one, this oldest girl. She had shut me out and wouldn't have anything to do with me at all. And for about 2 years after I quit drinking, she would still wouldn't talk to me. She had no relationship whatsoever. So pain, as I see it now, was almost unbearable. I had a hard time adjusting to this child. I tried the best I could. But anyway, after a couple of years, I came through home one day, and she was sitting in the den. And she wouldn't even speak to me. You know, she'd just come and go, and no relationship at all. But I guess she was maybe 15 or something. I don't remember exactly. But 2 or 3 years after I came in the program, she said, "Daddy." And that's the first time she had acknowledged my fatherhood at all. And it kind of shocked me. You know, I'm sometimes emotional about it, but this is the first time that she'd said anything acknowledging that I was around at all. And I stopped and talked to her, and she said, "I'm a pharmacist, as I mentioned. I finished Ole Miss in 1950. But she said, "Daddy, do you mind if I study pharmacy?" And of course, I said, "No, you study whatever you want to, you know." But as I look at it today, I think I had made amends with her probably at that time, maybe, that here this girl wanted to do what I was doing. And she went on to Ole Miss, and of course I had later 2 drugstores, and she worked for me 20-something years, and most of the time we worked together. And it's been real meaningful to me with these 4 children. The other girl, it didn't seem to affect as much, but I'm sure it did, but she joined Adult Children of Alcoholics several years ago, and it helped her deal with some of her emotions. And the oldest boy went to Vietnam and got messed up there, and he never drank or used drugs or anything, but he was disabled, and I've had to deal with that. But I'm so grateful that I'm here and was there when needed to be, he needed me, and I'm his guardian, and we get along fine. He's doing all right. The youngest boy was kind of my pet project. He had too many of my character defects, and I tried to send him to college. I think I sent him to 6 different schools, and it was a mess. He liked to party and play, and and didn't care about school, and finally, I let his mama deal with it. She'd been dealing in this Al-Anon stuff, and she was better capable of dealing with somebody with a problem like the youngest boy. So she just tried to put this tough love in it. So she told him that if he wanted to go to school, that he could pay for it. You know, he was a mess. But anyway, when he started paying, it seemed it got better. And he began to, anyway, he's a school teacher now, been for several years, and the wonderful part is, I was mentioning about the children, I've got 5 grandchildren, and I miss the young time of my children's life and didn't get a relationship, but these children have allowed me to be a relationship with little fellows, and I've got one at all the way from a junior in at Mississippi State to a little 2-year-old son, a grandson that the boys got. That I've got 1 little granddaughter that I idolize, and when you just got one, you can focus all your attention, and the boys let you, you know. So anyway, I carry them hunting and fishing with me, and that it's a dear and rewarding relationship to be able to have these blessings, the many of them that I've had added to me. I told Louise, I don't know whether I did or not, but I'm so delighted to see so many young people in the program. When I came in, it was a rarity, 35 years. You didn't see anybody less than 4. I was 38, and I was kind of young. And so many women that have come in. I tell this, and I hope nobody becomes offended, but it kind of, you know, women are judged by a different standard than men, you know, for their behavior and all forms of life, pay and everything. And when women came into the program, it was a real rewarding experience to be able to work with these people. And there wasn't many women, so you had in our group, so we had to work with them. But I heard a story of an old boy that had his wife and had a terrible drinking problem. And one morning he got up and he was trying to help her the best he could. And she had gotten up and sitting there with her head in her hands. He said, "Honey," he said, "how you feel?" She said, "I feel awful." "Oh, me." said, my head's killing me. Said, my stomach's all upset, you know, boiling and all this terrible thing. And said my nerves are shot. Said, I just can't stand it. And said, my right breast is burning just like it's on fire. Said, I don't know what's the matter. And anyway, he went back in the kitchen and got her, you know, something for her head, a pain pill of some sort, and got her some Pepto-Bismol, fixed it up and gave it to her for her stomach. And she'd been to the doctor and got her some tranquilizer or something. He brought her one of those and gave it to her. And he said, now if you get your left breast out of that cup of coffee, it'll put burning there. So that's women do have different problems. And I can identify with some of them. We in this program have, there are a number of things that are stumbling blocks. I came to the program, I was completely humiliated. And I think in order to be humble, you've got to be humiliated. You have to experience this thing in life. And I was upset. I had a lot of problems in relationship with my wife and children and some other people I hadn't got time to mention. But I also am convinced that God enters a broken heart much easier. I feel very sincerely that if you don't have a broken heart, God sometimes had a hard time getting in. So he entered rather quickly, and I'm grateful. I've got a number of things that I think are stumbling blocks, and I won't cover all of them because it'd be rather lengthy. But the last one that I'd like to touch on a minute is the unwillingness to accept divine guidance. That is, if it's one thing that I could pinpoint that an alcoholic would be troubled with, there are a number of others, but this is, for one thing, it's as simple as A, B, C. Number one, you got to accept the program completely and totally without any reservation. The B I'm thinking about is you got to believe without any doubt whatsoever that it will work. Excuse me. And the change, as I understand it, is the C means change. And if you're not willing to change, then you can't be successful in the program. You've got to be motivated to a certain degree. I'm reminded of the old fellow that prospector out digging for gold, and this fancy cowboy come riding up on his horse and had his 2.6 guns and a, you know, big hat and these shiny boots, and he got off the horse, and the old prospector was down there digging in the ditch and trying to pan out a little gold, and he took his shotgun out, and, I mean his six-shooters out, and asked the old fellow, said, do you know how to dance? And he said, no. So he began to shoot, bow, bow, bow. He shoots 12 times, and the old prospector jumping, you know, and dodging with his feet, and he said, but I've always wanted to. When the old fellow empties his gun, the old prospector went back to his mule and pulled a double-barrel shotgun out of the saddle and pointed at him and said, young man, he said, yes, sir. He said, you ever kiss a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. So you got to be motivated, and I think God is mentioned 9 times in the steps, and we're told repeatedly, and you have studied. My sponsor is a big book man. He stayed sober a year, about 1945, 1946, along the 46, before he knew of a program. Some fella gave him a big book, came in, and somebody told him he had a drinking problem. Evidently, everybody knew about it. Some 50 plus years ago, and this man gave him a big book and said, read this, maybe it'll help. He was from out of town, and he stayed sober a year on this big book. So naturally, when he became my sponsor, he was very emphatic that I utilize this big book, and I just about wore it out. A prisoner in the penitentiary made me a back to kind of cover it, put my name and AA on it, but I believe very sincerely that you need to utilize these tools that God gave us. And we're told that we're granted a daily reprieve, as you know, depending on our spiritual condition. And we're also told, as we try to help other human beings, that we need to burn into their mind the very pertinent fact that anyone can get well, no matter what position you're in, what's your station in life. Any man or woman can get well, but there are certain conditions. Though it says the only thing, I'll mention that only condition is that you trust in God. And it don't mean a lot of, only thing is you trust in God and learn to utilize the power that can sustain you and clean house. And I think that's what's gotten kept me sober. I have learned, I've been teaching Sunday school about 30 years, and I mentioned the fact that, and she's one of my students in my Sunday school class, my wife, and one day we were discussing the hereafter, and I don't know, they kicked it around. I'm the teacher, you know, kind of listening at different people. And somebody, one of my class members said, well, as I understand it, when you go to paradise, all your shortcomings and character defects and all the bad things that God don't like is wiped away. You come in, and she said, my wife, the dear student, I said, I better put a name tag on him. I wouldn't recognize him when I get there with all that gone. So that's the support I get from this woman. We're all shipwrecked, our book tells us, in the same vessel. A very humbling and leveling experience. No matter how old you are, how young you are, how strong you are, how weak you are, I've seen people that were professional football players that became, I've seen a little 98-pound man that couldn't hardly walk make it in this program. I've seen college professors. I worked with a man one time that couldn't read and write, and I didn't know it for 6 months. And Myrtle, his wife, was reading to him, reading the big book, and that's been 20 years, and that man is still sober. So there are no, as I see it, there's rarely a thing that will keep a man from keep getting and maintaining a degree of sobriety that you can live a fairly normal life. It also tells us that we are reunited under the same God. That's very meaningful to me also. I'll tell you, I think it's very important that I try to help other human beings as I was helping. I will share with you just a minute a couple of them. There was a lady one morning called, and my number was listed, and Peggy called and said she needed some help. It was about daylight one morning. I hadn't even gotten up. I got up and answered the telephone, and this lady was calling, and I got out of bed about half asleep, and she told me she needed some help, and I said, okay. I learned before I made one that you don't go by yourself to call on a lady, and so I took Madam Queen with me and as my guardian. And so we go out to find, I didn't get a chance to go. She called me, it hadn't been 10 minutes. You and I drunk, sorry. I should have already been there. She, when are you coming? I've called and you're not here yet. So I said, well, give me just a minute. Let me get my clothes on. And I got ready and I go out to the motel and oh boy. Peggy was a mess. She was laying up there in the bed, had on a shorty gown thing, and I don't know how long she'd been in this motel, a typical, and it really was, but anyway, she's sitting over there, and she thinks it's funny, you know, and she begins to tell me all of her problems, and one of her main problems is she had married this Indian out in Oklahoma, and had a wreck somewhere and killed him. Well, it's not funny, but anyway. The situation, and she had all these pictures of him in the casket, you know, must have had about 30 of them. She's showing me and crying, you know, and about she believes my big engine is gone. I said, yeah, from the looks of things, he's had it. And so when, and then she got to tell me about being somewhere and she got shot. And I didn't ask her where, but she insisted on showing me. Well, she raised her leg way up and it was up pretty high, and she thinks it's funny, you know. And anyway, we worried and worked with this dear lady, and she finally had to leave Clarksdale. Tell you the truth, I kind of knew about her. I had heard that she was a prostitute, and part of the time, and her brother-in-law was her pimp. He was a cab driver. And it was a horrible situation. What I'm saying is, anybody can recover. This poor girl, well, she finally left and kind of kept touch with me, and she went out in Texas somewhere. And lo and behold, about 6 or 8 years after she left, and I get a call one day, and she said, "Don," I said, "Yes." She said, "This is Peggy." I said, "Well, hey, Peggy, how you doing?" And, you know, she said, I wonder if you'd come out to Texas. I thought, oh, my God, not another one. Not another one in motel visit. But anyway, you know, that lady had been sober 6 or 8 years, and they were having some kind of roundup. I don't remember what the deal was. And she wanted to know if I'd come out and talk at her roundup. I think miracles, my God, if that poor woman, she had married this man, and she said, "I'll send you a plane ticket." She sent me a plane ticket to Houston, Texas. And I go out there and spend a day and a night with she and her husband, and she picked me up at the airport, and she was a completely different person. That is rewards the real joy of being sober. I'll tell you another situation. I had an old boy from up at Tullahoma, Tennessee. And most of y'all maybe know where Tullahoma is. I don't know where it is. I look at it on the map, but anyway, this old boy moved to Clarksdale. I didn't know anything about it, and I had the drugstore out in the shopping center. Went to work one morning, and a lady down the right next door come running in the drugstore about when I'd opened the drugstore and said, "Don," said, "there's a man out in front of your drugstore," or right between there, close to her shop, said, "he's, I don't know whether he's dead or alive. He was sitting up in the car there," and she said, "he's out, you know, he's not moving." And so I go out and look around, open the door, and then get him out. He was alive. He was in bad shape. But I told him, I said, "You get out and come on in my drugstore. Excuse me." I said, "Then, throw the police get you." So anyway, I get Don in the drugstore there and talk to him a while. And he had been sent to Clarksdale with this back years ago. They had a pollution control thing where they were trying to keep these gins and factors from, you know, damaging the atmosphere. And they had sent him. He was an intelligent fella. Kind of like Andy Griffith, had a funny dialect. Anyway, I talked to him and told him that looked like he's in a mess. He said, "Yeah." Anyway, I convinced him that he could use some help, and he did. He and his wife Hazel came in the program. From getting him out of the car in the parking lot. Well, I have worked a lot with people and have enjoyed it, and it's been real rewarding. But a funny thing had happened. I used to, when I was sponsoring somebody, every once in a while, if they had a home, I'd just go by unexpected. I don't announce myself. Don't call and say, "Can I come see you?" I just drop back. Well, that's the way you can tell how they're really doing, if you just catch them unaware. Well, I went by. I told you about one day. I said, "Let's go by and see Don Hazel. Maybe I'd check on him." You know, I go by, and oh, man, I kind of wished after I got there that I'd announced my coming, but the house was tore up. There were dishes and glass and all over the house. And there's he's sitting over here, and she's over here kind of looking at each other strangely, and kind of like she looked at me a few times. And I looked around the house. I said, "Don, what in the world happened?" He said, "Well, it wasn't bad, Don," said. "I accidentally knocked one of her whatnots off the shelf, a little old glass thing. It broke. And it made her mad, and so she got something of mine and broke it." Well, of course, I couldn't let her get in. They done broke up all the darn dishes and everything it would break. And we sat there and talked, and they got to laughing about it. You know, it got to be funny, you know. And we helped them clean up all the mess out of the house. And Don, a little later, went to Jackson and got a promotion and moved on with the Environmental Protection Agency or pollution control or whatever it was. But there again is part of the rewards that is so precious, other than my own personal family and wife and children, the love and the wonderful relationship I have with them. These many, many people down to 34 years, and it would fascinate me if I only had any idea how many. And I thought about my sponsor, 52 years sponsoring me, and a number of people. And it's fascinating how it branches out to hundreds of people that we've had. I'd sponsored a good many people, and they sponsored, and we called each other the grand sponsors and so forth. And that how this program works and permeated and enhanced and save the lives of so many people. It is fairly fascinating to me. I'll ever be grateful for the opportunity of utilizing such a program. I'll tell you one more thing before I close. My daddy was on his deathbed in 1953, and I hadn't begun to drink. And just before he died, he and I had a wonderful relationship, and he was my kind of my God for a while. And until he died, and he said, I hadn't got any problems, but I know I'm going to die very shortly, and it didn't bother him about dying. The only thing that bothered him was he said, be sure your mother's taken care of. And I promised him in 1953 that, and I meant it at that time, that I'd see that my mother was taken care of. So I was negligent of that faithful promise, and there for several years. But by the grace of God, I sobered up about 2 years before she died, and was able to make amends to her, and I did take care of her pretty well for those 13 years that she lived after he did. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so many rewards and so many blessings that there's no way I can describe it. There's no way I will ever be able to repay and put into the program what I've gotten out of it, what I've gotten seven and probably 70-fold the rewards of the of what I put in. In closing, I'd like to say that speakers are a dime a dozen, but people like you listening are hard to find. And I'm so grateful because that's been my salvation, to find that I would have found somebody, these dear people that understood, that were willing to listen to me. As I close, I'd like to say that may God guide and protect and watch over each of us until we meet again. I hope this light and power will guide and direct you so that never again will any of you people have to walk in fear and darkness and loneliness. Loneliness is a terrible thing. If you utilize this program, it'll never have to happen again. If you want love in your life, try really caring for another human being or other human beings if you really want to feel true love in your life. If you want real joy in your life, try sharing what you have with other human beings. If you want peace in your life, try practicing real true justice, because without justice, there can be no peace. If you mistreat somebody, there's going to be conflict. So practice justice. And with the help of God, practice some purity. Try to clean your life up and live as God would have you live. You've been a precious audience, and this has been a real meaningful weekend. Thank you so much.